Rosemary Martirana, Director of Intelligence here at the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness, NJOHSP, and you're listening to Intelligence Unclassified. This podcast is exactly what the title states, unclassified information about current trends in homeland security for the state of New Jersey, as well as educational information and resources for your awareness. Although it is produced every month, we aim to stay on top of current events and will often offer additional content. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for coming. Please feel free to add this podcast to your RSS feed or iTunes. You can also follow NJOHSP on Twitter at NJOHSP and Facebook. All links can be found in the show note and on our website, www.njohsp.gov. Hi, this is Rosemary Martirana, Director of Intelligence here at the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness. On March 18th, our office hosted its 10th anniversary conference, where over 600 of our public and private sector partners joined us to engage in valuable dialogue surrounding counterterrorism, resiliency, and cybersecurity issues. The day's events included insightful presentations from a wide array of experts who then graciously sat down with our podcast to delve deeper into some of their topics. Over the next several weeks, we will be hearing from the likes of Clint Watts, a Robert A. Fox Fellow for the Program on the Middle East and Senior Fellow for the Program on National Security at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, Lauren Steinberg, a terrorism analyst for the Anti-Defamation League's Center on Extremism, Hassan Safar, a senior civil rights and civil liberties official at the United States Department of Homeland Security, Deb Delvecchio Scully, a counselor and trauma specialist serving the Sandy Hook Newtown community, and Police Chief Jared Bergwan of San Bernardino. In this episode, intelligence analyst Angie Gadd from the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness interviews Clint Watts.
I'm here with Clint Watts. He is the Robert A. Fox Fellow in the Foreign Policy Research Institute's Program on the Middle East, as well as a Senior Fellow with its Program on National Security. Mr. Watts' research focuses on analyzing transnational threat groups operating in local environments. He served as a U.S. Army Infantry Officer and FBI Special Agent on the Joint Terrorism Task Force and Executive Officer of the Combating Terrorism Center at West Point. Mr. Watts will be speaking on the future of Al-Qaeda and ISIS, competition between the two groups, and implications for the United States. So to start off, we've been seeing the threat in the West from ISIS and Al-Qaeda evolve from large spectacular attacks to small-scale inspired attacks conducted by supporters or sympathizers, or even in some cases bandwagon attacks. So how do you think, or how much do you think ISIS and Al-Qaeda have determined that the U.S. is too hard to attack and have shifted more towards Europe?
I think the idea behind their terrorist attacks now is mostly local, and they're only going to orient either on Europe or the West whenever they really need to draw significant media attention to themselves to really expand their success. For the most part, they need to achieve success locally, and that's the only way they'll survive over time. So if they can't get that done locally, one way to sort of bring attention to your group, which brings resources and manpower, is to expand your network, expand to other locations geographically. So I think those groups that get frustrated over time will start to reach for other targets they can hit to bring that media attention towards them.
So in some of your previous work, you've categorized terrorists into directed, networked, and inspired. Could you briefly review the differences between them, and how would you characterize the attacks in Paris and San Bernardino?
Yeah, so directed attacks are those either Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State, the central leadership, actually designate the target, plan, and resource that, and really push to actually execute the attack. Networked attacks really come in two shapes. One, that's when an affiliate on their own picks a target that seems to match up with the objectives of both the group's affiliate and the Islamic State. Or it could be a former foreign fighter putting together through his own network some attacks, a plot, a local plot, and maybe they do light coordination with the central headquarters, but don't necessarily, run all of the logistics through them. Inspired are those that really have no physical relationship or connection back to either Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State, but take up their cause. And this really started back in the days of Anwar al-Awlaki, who said, if you can't get here, stay at home and do an attack. And you see that echoed by the Islamic State spokesman today. And so when you look at the Paris attacks, I think that's very much a directed attack. Only several months before that, he was in with the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. It's very well documented that he was seeking out an attack in the West. And he used the network that was there, so it was partly directed, partly networked, to facilitate that attack. San Bernardino, I see as an inspired attack. And what's interesting about that as an inspired attack is that they were persistently committed to a jihadi cause. You know, in the early days, they were focused on Al-Qaeda rhetoric, and they were looking at a lot of their propaganda. And as you move on, they were looking at Inspire magazine, and then you move to present day, It was really that there was the actions of the Islamic State, and particularly the Paris attacks, that really gave them that final push to go ahead and execute violence. An additional way to look at inspired attacks is really, I call it two kinds. One's the persistently committed, which I think is a San Bernardino case. A previous one to that would be Nidal Hassan, who was really reaching out, trying to make connections to the group, and ultimately decided to undertake attack on his own. And you see a bleeding of motivations there. It's part workplace violence, and it's part, you know, Islamic terrorism. At the same point, you see inspired attacks, which I call headline inspired. And these are people that are mostly motivated for ego and psychological reasons. And so if you look at the Philly shooter shooting a police officer and saying, oh, this is on behalf of the Islamic State, or dozens of other attacks, what you notice about them is they're poorly planned and not well resourced. They're random in terms of the targets that they select, and they happen rather quickly or in spurts. One of the great research things I think to look at is like how suicides tend to bring on other suicides. Like they somehow push people over a tipping point. That headline inspired is very similar, I think. When they see the success of another attack, then they want to jump into that bandwagon.
So lately we've been seeing ISIS suffer key territorial losses in Iraq and Syria. However, there has been a constant ebb and flow of losses and wins with the group. What are a few factors that you think would critically weaken or serve a decisive blow to ISIS?
I think for the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, the key would be if you can really take Raqqa, their stronghold in Syria, that would create a fracturing effect across their state. It would be very hard for them to conduct logistics, do taxation, maintain their finances. So taking that central stronghold would be key. The other one that's already happening now is you're seeing a lot of defectors from the Islamic State's ranks and a lot of people in the ranks being killed off by internal spies. And that's always a classic sign of a group that's on its way out. If we can continue to promote that, you'll see the foreign fighter flow really dry up. And I think you'll see splinters within the Islamic State's ranks where local Sunnis try and take, you know, some sort of local power and they might splinter from the group.
So we've been discussing this in the office. Do you think if they were to take Raqqa, for example, would you see ISIS maybe shifting to Libya or any of the key leadership maybe going to Libya?
It's already happening. Yeah. So I think the key signature to look for right now is, one, where are foreign fighters from Iraq and Syria going? And in particular, where are Iraqis or Syrians showing up? And we've already seen that in Libya, where some of them have been targeted. I'm waiting to see some of them pop up in Lebanon. We know Turkey is infested in many ways with a lot of former foreign fighters, and I'm sure we're going to see it there as well. But that will be the key. In the Al-Qaeda days, when you saw someone from Afghanistan and Pakistan pop up, let's say, in the Sahara, then you knew there were strong connections between those two affiliates. That's the same thing that I would look for today.
So beyond Al-Qaeda and ISIS, can you speak to what you anticipate to be the next trend or terrorist attack phenomenon that might be coming in the next few years? Or what terrorist group do you think is sort of up and coming right now?
I think what we'll see is 5 to 7 regional nodes that have both an Islamic State or an Al-Qaeda affiliate or an independent group, all of them with former foreign fighters who are experienced in combat, competing in lots of different ways. And to take a really odd but instructive case is Southeast Asia. Right now, we're seeing a resurgence in Southeast Asia of terrorism that we haven't seen in over a decade, and it was kind of thought that it was squashed out. The Islamic State's so-called branded group has reached out even into the Philippines with other satellite groups. And so I think in some places you'll see an Al-Qaeda affiliate that's a little bit stronger, and other places you'll see an Islamic State affiliate that's stronger. And then we'll begin to question, like, are any of these groups really connected to each other? Is it just a local phenomenon? And I think that's really what we'll see moving forward.
So on that note, you had a recent piece with Brookings, and it discussed the future of ISIS and Al-Qaeda, and you offer readers 3 points to assist them in forecasting the future direction of ISIS and Al-Qaeda. So one of them suggests monitoring the migration of foreign fighters as ISIS declines to identify the future trouble spot. I know we just spoke about this, but many of the foreign fighters that are with ISIS are coming from the Middle East and will likely return back to their home country. So how do you anticipate this affecting the region, or more specifically, could there be even more proliferation of terrorism across the Middle East, and how will that impact the already fragile state of instability? I know there's a lot of questions.
No, that was a very simple question. But in one sense, what's different about this one is we have a strong sectarian thread that's running through it. With Al-Qaeda, we didn't have that. So when they broke up, it still was, let's focus on the West, or let's focus on European countries, apostate regimes. With the Islamic State, we've seen this sectarian flavor between Sunni and Shia flow into it. And so what I think will happen over the time is a lot of these terrorist groups and small affiliates will become proxies for state sponsors, which we have not seen really. And you'll look at Iran, who will see maybe at times a Sunni fragment of the Islamic State could be a useful tool against them against the Saudi regime, or vice versa. You could see some sort of combination that's there. So a lot of this terrorist violence we've always seen is just non-state actors and then, you know, state actors. I think there'll be a more blended phenomenon there, particularly in the Middle East. And that really is already happening in Yemen right now.
To shift a little from ISIS and Al-Qaeda, what do you think has been the biggest improvement in our counterterrorism efforts since 9/11?
I would say the biggest thing is becoming more measured in terms of our actions and thinking through what our options are and not moving too quickly at times. So there's always been this pressure since 9/11 that there's going to be another big attack right around the corner. And so any means are necessary to do that. And we tended to overstep in a lot of ways. We would push counter-terrorists too hard. They would just go ahead and aggravate populations, or we would try and clear hold and build and rebuild nations. And that didn't work either. And what I think we see now and see with Director Brennan speaking today is this whole notion of the disposition matrix. What are our options? What are our capabilities in every country around the world? What's the most appropriate and best way in a limited fashion to execute counterterrorism? And I think what you're seeing both in the Horn of Africa today and what's really happened in Syria and Iraq is a lighter footprint and the more deliberate, you know, patient approach. And I think that's a good evolution for us as a country.
So what do you perceive are our biggest opportunities in counterterrorism efforts in the future?
I think right now the issue with defectors is huge. They are a great weapon for us against the Islamic State's narrative and al-Qaeda's. The leading cause of death for jihadis is always jihadis. They tend to kill their own much more than we kill them. And so I think that's a message that we can really proliferate through there. The other thing I think that's happened is the ideology of jihadism has really been diluted. It used to be there were established clerics that put this out. Now it's a 22-year-old guy who's on social media. And so that will really, I think, over time, while it seems very powerful right now and there's a lot of affinity for it, over time you're really going to see this sort of loss of support for this fringe cause. And you see it today. There's more Arab countries mobilized against the Islamic State than we ever got to mobilize against al-Qaeda.
So lastly, what is one good resource you would recommend to our listeners? Or could you maybe tell us what book you're currently reading?
Currently, what am I reading? Jihad in America by Peter Bergen. I just started that. I think The Terrorist Dilemma is a great book by Jake Shapiro. I think that's an essential book to read. And then ISIS Apocalypse by Will McCants. Those are the three that I would throw out right now as three different perspectives on the terrorism problem.
Thank you so much, Clint.
Thank you.
Again, all links can be found in the show notes and on our website at www.njohsp.gov. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe to Intelligence Unclassified.